Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. For by it the elders obtained a good report. Through faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. I hope you'll pardon me if I have to visit this water glass very often. Some of you may know I had throat cancer. I went for about 8 months. I couldn't talk. The radiation from that ailment left me with a permanent case of dry mouth. The doctor told me it's going to be that way. Just live with it. Well, I'd started wrapping up my affairs. I started boxing up my library and cataloging it. Bought a grave lot and gravestones. He says, live with it. I said, sounds good to me. And so he said, now, it's never going to sound the way it used to. Said, it's always going to be raspy. I said, well, maybe that's an improvement. I always thought it was right squeaky. So maybe raspy will be an improvement. But anyway, I'll have to visit that glass every now and again. Through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things which do appear. In 1789, a group of men met in Philadelphia and drafted what I believe is the most remarkable document ever drawn by men, any document that is not directly inspired of God. Our United States Constitution was not divinely inspired. Who would dare claim that? But I don't doubt that God did assist those men in much the same way that he assists a preacher when the preacher is preaching with power. Later, they adopted some 10 amendments to that Constitution. The first of those amendments says that Congress shall pass no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. What an amazing statement that is. And how very much we owe to that document and to that statement that Congress shall pass no law regarding the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But the fact of the matter is that after 200 years, we do have an unofficial established religion. And that religion is required to be taught in our schools. And no other religion is allowed to be taught. And we are, every one of us, taxed in order to pay for the propagation of that religion. The religion I'm talking about is the religion of evolution. And evolution is a religion. Evolution is not science. Evolution has nothing to do with science. evolutionists use scientific sounding language to make it sound like the evolution religion is science after all. But evolution is religion. You see, evolutionists may often refer to themselves as atheists. Now, there are those who claim to be theistic evolutionists. But the evolutionist is just as religious as you are. He believes in a God as surely as you do. He just believes in a different kind of God than you do. Do you see, the Bible teaches that in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. The evolutionist believes that the universe created itself by the forces, powers, and properties inherent in the universe. Do you see, the universe is here. You can't deny it. Now, I know that the Hindu religion denies it. They say that the universe is all in your head. But anyway, that's another subject. I don't want to go there. But anyway, the universe is here. And how does the evolutionist explain it? He explains that everything you see was produced by the forces and properties inherent in the universe. In the old day, the ancient pagans worshipped a goddess they called Venus or Diana or Hera or Astarte. They had a multitude of different names for her. Our modern pagans still worship Venus, still worship Diana, Hera, Astarte, but now our modern pagans call her Mother Nature. You see, they had to change the vocabulary so that we wouldn't notice that it's the same religion it always has been. I want us to look first at the four reasons. There are four reasons that people believe in evolution. Now, there's a fifth, but I want to look at that in a moment. But anyway, four reasons that people believe in evolution. The first two are very similar, not quite the same, very similar. The first reason is that most people who believe in evolution believe that they couldn't care one way or the other. Doesn't make a bit of difference to them. If everybody else believes in evolution, that's all right with me. I can understand that. There are a lot of things that don't make a bit of difference to me, and if somebody wants to believe that, that's all right. I understand that here a while back there was something in South Africa called the World Soccer Cup. I heard about that on television and heard about it. No offense to those folks who enjoy soccer. I'm just not into any kind of sports. It doesn't do a bit thing for me. I've always been a kind of a wimp. In order to get much out of sports, you got to feel yourself out there on the field taking the hit. Is that right? And if you can't somehow feel yourself out there on the field taking the hit, you don't get near as much out of it as you would otherwise. So I've always been a little bit of a wimp, and I never could see myself out there, so I never have been into sports the way most folks are. But at no time during that was going on, the time that was going on, did I know who was playing, who was ahead, who was behind. And to this day, I don't know how it turned out. Okay. But you know, most people believe in evolution for that same reason. It doesn't make a bit of difference to them one way or another. If that's the way it is, that's the way it is, and don't bother me. If you tried to argue with them about it, they don't want to argue with about it. They, you know, they're not just not interested in it. The second reason that so many people believe in evolution is very much the same. They just believe what they're told. Folks are generally very gullible, especially about things that they don't want to spend the time investigating and digging into it. You see, they know that evolution has to be right because it's in the book, and they wouldn't let them put it in the book if it wasn't right. You know, if it's in the book, I never have figured out who they are. But they know, you know, that they just wouldn't let them put it in the book if it wasn't right. They teach it in school. And you know, they wouldn't allow them to teach it in school if it wasn't right. There's a third reason. There are those who believe or go along with evolution because of intimidation. I'm forever reading an article about somebody not being able to get an article published in one of the scientific publications because they believe in creation. And if you don't go with the company line, then you don't get published. Just a while ago, I read an article by a man who was complaining. He was trying to get into a graduate school at one of the largest universities. And the head of his department refused to sign off, wouldn't give him a recommendation, said, "You don't believe in evolution, I'm not going to sign off, you're not getting in." So he appealed to the hierarchy there at the university. The university backed up the head of his department, said, "No, you don't get into graduate school here if you don't subscribe to evolution." Do you see, the wicked, and that is a wicked doctrine, by the way, the wicked have always been better politicians than the righteous. That's the reason there are so many crooked politicians. Because they're better at getting the job. They're willing to do things in order to get the job, to get in positions of power that a person who listens to his conscience will not do. They're better at inserting themselves in positions of power and elevating other people who have the same point of view. We hear people talking over and over about some particular professor. There was one, I think his name was Churchill, in some university, I forget where. But anyway, there was a move to drive the man out of his position because of some of the outrageous positions that he took. Well, it didn't help to appeal to the hierarchy there at that particular university. They were very much of the same mind that he was. Do you see, ever so many people either believe or go along with evolution because of intimidation. They go along to get along. That expression applies in a lot of situations, does it not? You go along to get along. There's a fourth reason. that ever so many people are so dedicated to the notion of evolution. Aldous Huxley was the grandson of Thomas Huxley. Now, you may never have heard of either of those names. You've heard of the name Charles Darwin, I'm sure. Thomas Huxley was Charles Darwin's bulldog. Darwin worked with the theory. Huxley was the man that was aggressive in driving that idea, pushing it on the people. Aldous Huxley was his grandson. Aldous Huxley, in about 1930, 31, 32, thereabouts, published the book Brave New World. Some of you may be familiar with that book. The theme of the book, now bear in mind, this was written about 1930. And it was fiction, but it wrote about an age when television programming would be used for the purpose of conditioning people to immorality. Most people never heard of television in 1930, would you think? But Aldous Huxley allowed, and now he put that date about 500 years in the future. His idea was right. His date was way off. But anyway, the theme of his book was an age when television would be used to condition people to be immoral. But anyway, this is the grandson of Thomas Huxley, who had about as much to do with establishing the modern version of evolution as any other person did. Someone asked Mr. Huxley, why were he and his people so dedicated to the notion of evolution? Why, they wanted to know, is it so important for people to believe in evolution? He gave a very honest answer. He said, if creation is right, if God is our creator, we belong to him. He said, if God is our creator, he's our judge, and he has the right to tell us how that we must behave. And he said, we don't intend for anybody to tell us how we should live our lives. Okay. The fourth reason then that people believe, and this applies to some, not the majority by any means. Not the majority by any means. But it applies to the movers and shakers in that movement. The reason they are so dedicated to that movement is that they do not intend to be answerable to anybody for their conduct. We said there is a fifth reason. Evolutionists will tell you that this is the reason. They believe in evolution. They'll tell you they believe in evolution because of the evidence. Okay? For a little while, let's look at some of the evidence. Charles Darwin published his book in 1859, insisted that man and apes, monkeys, and so on, are all descended from an original primate, which he said was now extinct. Darwin did not actually teach that we're descended from monkeys. He taught that we and monkeys and apes are all descended from something way back there, some kind of primate that's extinct now. So really what he taught was that we're distant cousins. same difference really. So he taught that we're descendant from animals, an original primate. And somebody wanted to know, well, where is the proof? He allowed the proof is in the fossils. Well, where are the fossils? We haven't found them yet, but give us time, we'll find them. Now, it is a strange kind of science that reaches its conclusions and then goes out looking for evidence. Do you see, if evolution was real science, they would have found their evidence and then reached their conclusions. But they reached the conclusions and now they're looking for evidence. That was in 1859. Well, it rocked on and still they couldn't find the evidence. Found all kinds of fossils, but nothing that would support the theory. And then in 1912, a school teacher by the name of Charles Dawson, Charles Darwin, Charles Dawson, two different names, who lived in Piltdown, England, discovered a skull and jawbone that really was part human, part simian. And it went in all the textbooks. When I started in high school, it was still in the textbooks. The Piltdown man, discovered in a gravel pit in Piltdown, England. And I well remember one day, I break out in just chill bumps just now thinking about that day. But I well remember one day I was a junior in high school, 1953. I was in study hall there at Friendsville High School, a little country school, East Tennessee. I was reading one of the weekly news magazines, either Time or Newsweek, and I found a little article, just a little tiny article, buried way over in the science section. You see, when they discovered the Piltdown man, it was spread across the front page of newspapers and magazines all over the world. In 1953, they examined that skull again. And they discovered that it really was a human skull. But it was not 300,000 years old. It was more like 1,000 years old. And that jawbone, it wasn't 300,000 years old either. Fact about it, it wasn't fossil. Still bone. And they had taken very fine sandpaper to sand the TMJ joint and make it fit. And they had treated the jawbone with iron salts, iron pyrites, to make it look old. But it took the world's most brilliant scientists 41 years to notice that it was a hoax. I have a book in my library at home written by James Treffield, an evolutionist scientist. It's been there I've had the book about 20 years, so this goes back a little way. But when he wrote the book, it hadn't been long since he had been to London. And he visited the London Museum. And he was writing about the Piltdown hoax now. And he said, it's still on display. I'll have to take his word for it. I've never been there. He said, it's still in a glass case. And he said, you can look through the glass case and see the sandpaper marks. Do you get the idea there was something not quite honest about the whole thing? But you see, that's all right. That's all right. If God's not our creator. If we're just the end result of a long series of accidents, then it's none of God's business if we falsify the information, you see. Purely a hoax. But it took the world's most brilliant scientist 41 years to find out about it. The story doesn't end there. As it happens, Charles Dawson didn't find that skull after all. There were four men on that dig. There was Charles Dawson, another man by the name of Woodard, and a Jesuit priest by the name of Teilhard de Chardin. And after they had searched out a particular area, couldn't find anything, they've moved on to another area in this gravel pit. And here comes Mr. Teilhard de Chardin with this skull. Look what I found. They'd already searched out that area and didn't find anything. He comes running up. Look what I found. He had found the skull. This, so far as I know, is still on display there in the London Museum. Let me shift gears just a little bit, and then we'll tie this together. Most of you are acquainted with a movement called New Age, the New Age movement. Neo-paganism has to do with the power of crystals, the power of the pyramid, communicating with spirits, communicating with the dead, and so on. You see, that it's neo-paganism. It's simply a resurrection of the old paganism. There are three names that figure the most prominently in the revival of what has come to be known as New Age. There's a woman by the name of Annie Besant, another lady by the name of Madame Blavatsky, and the third name, the father of the New Age movement, Teilhard de Chardin. Do you see why Charles Dawson claimed credit for finding that? Do you see why they couldn't put it into the papers and magazines all over the world that Mr. Teilhard de Chardin was the man that discovered it? They wouldn't have dared tell the world that the man who was the father of the New Age movement was the man who claimed to have found the Piltdown skull. So Mr. Dawson claims credit for it. So much for the Piltdown man. Let me look at another evidence. There's a display that, so far as I know, is still in the books. The last I checked, it was. It's a series of pictures of the human fetus from not long after conception until not long before birth. And it shows the development of the human fetus at the first. Looks somewhat like a tadpole, and then it goes through various stages. At one point, it's supposed to look like it has gills and so on. And that display is called ontological recapitulation. They love those long names. That makes them sound like they know something, do you see? here a while back, I was studying something about sedimentary rock and how sedimentary rock was formed. And I kept reading about something called detritus. He was talking about that stuff that kind of looks like trash between two layers of sedimentary rock. And I've worn out a lot of dictionaries. There's a lot of words I don't know the definition of. But anyway, I got to wonder, now, what is detritus? It's that stuff, you know, between the layers in sedimentary rock. And I go and get my dictionary and look up detritus. That's Latin for trash. Latin for trash. Why couldn't they just say so? Why couldn't they just say so? But you see, it makes them sound a whole lot brighter if they call that trash detritus. So they give this presentation, ontological recapitulation. It created a literal firestorm in the scientific community. This was 100 years ago, before so many of the scientific community bought into that idea. Why did it create a firestorm? Because everybody knew it was a forgery. It's obvious, forgery. The pictures had all been doctored. There was a firestorm that raged over that, trying to use this to demonstrate evolution, but it's pure forgery. After 100 years, it's still there. Why? Because you see, it's all right. It's all right. If God's not our creator, it's all right to forge the evidence. So much for that. You remember the monkey trial, Dayton, Tennessee? Leading up to the monkey trial, the ACLU put advertisements in Tennessee newspapers trying to find somebody willing to teach evolution in a Tennessee school, be arrested, put on trial. The trial was in 1925. The ACLU was started in 1920. Anybody that thinks the ACLU started off right and got wrong has never studied the history of the ACLU. Those who started that hated God with a vengeance. They hated the name of Jesus Christ as much then as they do now. And the purpose in establishing that organization was to drive the name of Jesus Christ out of existence. But anyway, leading up to that trial, there was an evolutionary scientist by the name of Harold Cook who discovered a tooth in Nebraska, the tooth of an extinct ape man. Got in all the papers. They were able to take that tooth, and from that tooth, they were able to discover that the man's mouth protruded, that his forehead was sloped, had heavy brow ridges, that he walked all stooped over, his knuckles almost dragged the ground. Mark Twain was still in his heyday about that time. And Mark Twain made the comment, "It is amazing," he said, "what a harvest of conclusions you can draw from such a paltry investment of facts." Well, for some reason, they never did bring up the Nebraska man in the monkey trial. It looked like they were going to. They never did. But anyway, they gave the Nebraska man one of those fancy names, Hesperopithecus Harold Cooki. You know, they like to tack their name on the end so that 100 years from now, when anybody refers to that, they got to say their name. It's amazing what people will do for a little bit of recognition. But anyway, they went back later to Snake Creek, Nebraska. I like that name. They went back to Snake Creek and they found the rest of the skeleton. And they found out that he didn't have heavy brow ridges, didn't have a sloping brow, mouth didn't protrude, didn't walk all stooped over. It was a pig. It was a pig. was a pig. More than that, he wasn't even extinct. A few years later, 1927, I believe was the year, a scientist by the name of Harold Wenzel found an entire herd of those same pigs in South America. So much for their evidence. Do you see? Evolution is not science. You see, they're not bound by the rules. It's a pagan religion. Charles Darwin did not originate the notion. Fact about it, according to reliable reports, he plagiarized most of his book from another anthropologist by the name of Russell. Mr. Russell sent his manuscript to Charles Darwin to critique for him, and Darwin got to the publisher before the other man did. But again, that's all right. That's all right, do you see? That's all right if God's not our creator, he's not our judge, and it's none of his business. But I believe that he is our creator. I believe that he is our judge. And to the best of my ability, I want to do what he commands. Evolution, religion, superstition, really. What is superstition? Superstition is any notion firmly held that is not supported by proof. Okay. Evolution is superstition. You don't have to take a back seat to any of those folks. God gave to Job the proper response to those people something like 4,000 years ago. Let me read it to you. In Job chapter 38, then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, years ago I was working with a good friend of mine. He was my manager back when I was in the insurance business. And we had been having a long-running conversation about religion. And he seemed to feel like he was getting the short end of the deal. And one day he said, Harold, did you ever wish that God would just speak from heaven and say, okay, everybody, listen up. I'm going to tell you the way it is. I said, James, what do you think the Bible is? What do you think this book is all about? Listen, Job 38. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, here's God speaking from heaven, speaking out of the whirlwind. He says, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? Now, in East Tennessee, we never do use that expression. I never have had anybody talk about darkening counsel by words without knowledge. Now, in East Tennessee, we do talk about blowing smoke. Okay. You know, you laugh like you've heard that expression before. You see, that's what God is saying here. God says to Job, who is this that darkeneth counsel by words without knowledge? He says, Job, you're just blowing smoke. He says, gird up now thy loins like a man, for I will demand of thee an answer thou me. He said, Job, you and your buddies have been mouthing off, saying a lot of things that were true and just about as much that wasn't true. He says, now I'm going to ask the questions and you tell me. He says, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? He says, Job, were you there? These evolutionists talk like they were. He says, where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Declare if thou hast understanding. Who hath laid the measures thereof, if thou knowest, or who has stretched the line upon it? Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof? He says, Job, how do you know? Were you there? There's a good brother who has a lot to say about creation, evolution. He teaches young children in school. When an instructor gets too strident, too overbearing about this notion of evolution, to ask the teacher, how do you know? Were you there? No, but it's in the book. Was he there? How does he know? Well, I know somebody that was there. I know somebody that was there, and he's given me the record of how it was. And he never does lie. I've known people who lied, but God never has. You know, that question is so simple. I believe a little third-year-old could ask it, don't you? And I believe a little third-year-old could know if somebody was blowing smoke trying to give an answer to it. How do you know? Were you there? No, I wasn't there, but I know somebody that was. And he tells everybody, tells us everything we know, need to know about it. What makes you think he knows? Look around. He's holding all this up. If he's not holding it up, who he is? And he tells me that he created it. And I just believe that's right. Let us stand and sing. If there's one who desires a home in the church, in any way we old Baptists receive members, you come forward just now, and this church will hear you. What is your selection? 158.